We borrow money from Chinese peasants to buy the things those Chinese peasants manufacture. That was the US Vice President J.D. Vance in early April, typically forthright, describing the trading relationship of the world's two largest economies, the US and China. What has the globalist economy gotten the United States of America? He continued. To discuss China's rise, its subsequent entry into the international trading system, and its contemporary status as the problem child of our globalised world, I'm joined by Michael Sheridan, author of two books on China and a foreign correspondent for 40 years, and EI senior editor Paul Lay. Michael, take us into the debates around China's rise in the 90s. How was it perceived, especially among its close neighbours?
There were a lot of peasants in China in the 1990s, and they built the economy that we have seen today. Among the things that J.D. Vance gets wrong are that the US treasuries held by China are not a form of debt to Chinese peasants. They are exchanged for US dollars, for which the Chinese government has issued yuan to its exporters. So it's a mutually assured destruction currency exchange. And it misunderstands the nature of trans-Pacific trade to label it as a simple bargaining chip between imports and exports. It's been a reciprocal relationship. One thing you can see from the beginning is that the Chinese economy was strained and it was constrained, and then it was poised for takeoff at the end of the 1980s. They had experimented with reform. It had led to inflation and chaos and insecurity and partly sowed the seeds of the 1989 movement for democracy. The Communist Party crushed that movement violently. But it then found that it had to address the same problems which China had attempted to deal with through partial reforms in the 1980s. I remember riding the train from Hong Kong through the former rice fields up to Guangzhou and the cities of the Delta in the early 90s, and you could sense the enormous restless expansion in the whole region. Factories belching filth into the sky night and day, trains and lorries overwhelming the infrastructure that was there, the cities hastily built, peasants flowing in their millions, not in their thousands, in their millions, in search of opportunity. So the Chinese leadership knew that it had unleashed something here in these southern provinces, where, by the way, Xi Jinping's father was one of the leading lights of economic reform. And it had to find a method of integrating itself into the world because there was no domestic demand. The Chinese economy needed domestic demand to consume the products it was going to make, and that didn't exist. So at the beginning of the 1990s, the party and the new technocratic generation, 10 to 20 years younger than the venerable leaders, realized it had to change. And that's what led to China deciding to embrace what they call reform and opening up to the outside world.
You talk about like China's entry into the world economy. Did that cause disquiet with its close neighbours? How did they see this belching industrial heartland?
Most of China's neighbours in Asia welcomed the opportunity. There was an air of optimism. People felt that China had been the world's largest economy for many years in past centuries. And the satellite countries of East Asia felt that they could benefit. They weren't particularly afraid at that time of China conquering their markets. Many of them saw opportunity. So Japanese manufacturers, for example, saw huge potential markets in the Chinese domestic economy. South Korea was among the first to get in there with industries and reciprocal trade. Exporters, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, other rice exporters, all saw opportunity. So there was a lot of positive feeling inside and outside China, despite the horror of Tiananmen Square, and this sense that the early 90s were the beginning of an equilibrium. And stability is the one thing that East Asian governments crave because they had so little of it in the last century.
What role did Hong Kong play in that picture? Was it the financial expertise lubricating the industry? How did that help it develop?
Well, I call Hong Kong the gate to China in my book on the place, and the function it exercised was revolutionary, because at first foreign companies thought that China was a big market and they could sell things to Chinese people in China. And then they realised, with Hong Kong leading the way, that you could turn that argument inside out. So what then happened was the realisation by corporations that you could make things in China to sell to people outside China. And at the same time, you could satisfy domestic demand for those products if it existed. There was a Chinese family called Li and Fung. They started one of the first outsourcing chain management firms, and they pioneered the way into the Pearl River Delta. They took investment and management expertise and they built factories using incentives which the Chinese government issued to them. And they began manufacturing things to go out. Some of those things were shipped through Hong Kong, so they became a kind of invisible export, and some of them went directly to markets overseas. They invented the supply chain. And the stroke of genius that Li and Fung had was to realise that you could create a seamless system linking the manufacturer, the wholesaler, and the consumer in foreign countries. And you could do it all via the financial networks of Hong Kong, which had a hyper-functional international banking system, a free port, free exchange of currencies, no restrictions on trade, and it was the ideal gateway for China. So that's why Hong Kong became so important on pure economic grounds alone.
And so what we're seeing here is the beginnings of, you've used the word revolution in terms of this supply chain, a revolution in supply chains. How was that comprehended by the West at that point? Were they blindsided by it?
It was very hard to grasp the scale in the 1990s. Although I was there from the middle 90s onwards, went to China a lot, saw factories, you could witness change by the week. It was an extraordinary period. I sometimes said to people it was like watching the pyramids being built. And it was difficult to grasp the scale. When I went back and went into the documents and the Chinese records for the Hong Kong book, I found a statistical yearbook for the province of Guangdong in 1996. At one point, certain industrial sectors were growing by 40% a year. You couldn't stop it. And even humdrum industries like clothes manufacturing were multiplying at 20% a year. And I remember going to bankers' dinners and events in Hong Kong and listening to people from HSBC and Standard Chartered and Citibank and Morgan Stanley and so on, talking with awe and wonder and some fear just about the numbers. You couldn't ignore it. And so the policy, if there was a policy, was driven by what Marxists would call vast impersonal economic forces. And Wall Street and the Fortune 500 responded to it. That was the beginning of globalization.
And just to zoom out, at the same time, the leading powers are pushing for reform to GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is a central pillar of the post-war order, the creation of the WTO in 95. What's the vision there, and what did it get wrong about the Chinese development?
The vision that they had in reforming the GATT was to create a universal, all-embracing system for world trade. The GATT, by and large, only dealt with goods. It didn't deal with services, and it lacked a strong enforcement mechanism. So the ideal, and it was an ideal in the early to mid-1990s, was that you would create a world trading system with a level playing field, rules-based, to use an unfashionable term, and with sanctions and enforcements, which would be arbitrated in Geneva at the WTO headquarters. Now, J.D. Vance is not wrong when he describes, very poetically and with great brilliance, the destruction of the American industrial heartlands in his native Appalachia and in other industrial centres of the United States, because the process was very fast. And manufacturers discovered that once a Chinese production line was up and running, you could source your product for a fraction of the cost required to build it in the United States. The truth is that, like other big policy decisions of the 1990s, voters weren't asked to vote on it. So the people who support President Trump and Vice President Vance argue that this just happened to them. They didn't choose it. And faceless corporations, aided by bureaucrats, simply decided to outsource manufacturing to China. And they did it so quickly and so effectively that many Americans didn't wake up to it until it had happened. The Chinese, for their part, took a much more long-term and rational look at it. Two things you can say. One is that the leadership was inspired. I'm not saying it was right or it was ideologically correct, but they were truly communist trained in seizing opportunity. Party members are trained in discipline to seize opportunity, and they did that. And the other thing that is irrefutable is that Chinese peasants did not have a vote, but they voted with their feet, and they went in their millions to the coastal provinces to work because they wanted to work. They wanted to work and save and invest and get homes and educate their children and do all the things which people in advanced countries had been doing for several generations.
Take us inside the debate in China about entry to the WTO. What are the main personalities advocating entry, and are there people who don't want to get into the WTO, this capitalist club?
The Communist Party was shaken by the events of 1989. It watched traditional communism evaporate across Eastern Europe, Soviet Union, the former Soviet states. They reacted violently, as I've said, at Tiananmen Square, but after that they decided to adjust politically. At the time, there was none of the rhetoric which Xi Jinping now indulges in about the communist fall of the Soviet Union and the lack of backbone among communists and so on. They took a much softer approach. I mean, they dealt with Gorbachev. They watched Perestroika. They saw the difficulties of adjusting a state-planned economy. But it wasn't easy. First of all, the older generation of revolutionaries, by and large, distrusted foreigners. They quite rightly felt, at an early stage of reform, that all these foreign businesses were queuing up to sell things to China which it couldn't afford and didn't really need, and they were just trying to exploit it as they had done in the 19th century. That attitude is very hard to shake. Then there was a group, I would say, of technocrats around the head of the central bank, a politician called Zhu Rongji, one of the most remarkable men in late 20th century China. He was the mayor of Shanghai in 1989 when I was there in the middle of the protests. And he is the man that declined to use the Tiananmen solution in Shanghai. He may well have saved thousands of lives. He and the party secretary, a man named Jiang Zemin, organized a transition from anarchy to repression over the course of 10 days in Shanghai, and they did it almost without firing a shot. That was the alternative for Tiananmen. They then seized that opportunity. Jiang Zemin becomes head of the party, president of China. Zhu Rongji takes over the central bank and becomes ultimately prime minister. He was a technocrat. He was a fierce communist, no doubt about that. He was not a soft, cuddly liberal. But he had a vision for China, which was a China integrated into the world economy and in which the talents and enterprise of its people would be given play to develop cities like Shanghai, which both men knew, both Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, absolutely knew the history and background and economic life of Shanghai. They wanted to spread that to other parts of the country so that more parts of China could develop rapidly and pull the rest with them. Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader at the time and the eminence grise behind the scenes, said that it was justified in Marxism for some people to get rich first. It's one of his famous catchphrases. So Zhu Rongji's writings and speeches show us, when we read them in hindsight, that they had a very measured vision. They wanted China to advance cautiously but relentlessly into world markets, and they wanted to do it without disrupting political order. In fact, the more enlightened Chinese politicians saw that if you had prosperity, if you created a middle class, if you opened up a bit and you let people travel and you let in global influences, the optimistic case was that that would lead ultimately to liberalisation. As we know, that turned out to be a false hope. But at the time, it was genuinely believed by reformers in the Chinese government. And of course, it was eagerly embraced by Wall Street and the investors who didn't want to hear anything else. So it was a strategic choice. They ran up against significant opposition. There's a man called Chen Yun, who was one of the old guard around Mao. These were communists who firmly believed in the iron hand of state control. They had experienced privations and horrors in the 1930s and 40s, which we can scarcely grasp, and they were determined not to let that happen again. So they feared a dissolution of communist values and socialist values by the corrosive arrival of capitalism. Now, Xi Jinping himself, when he was the party chief on the eastern coast of China in different provinces, he saw at first hand and was caught up in some of the scandals when China turned into a kind of Wild West and there were gangsters and mafias and corruption and officials being bought off and massive smuggling. He was in one city where China's biggest smuggling racket ever was going on under his nose. They knew they had to deal with this stuff, but they also recognised that it was an inescapable byproduct of opening up a rigid economy. So what WTO offered to them, and Zhu Rongji says this, we know this because he said it in publicly disclosed documents, was a way for China to modernise itself and to embrace market principles within a framework. So, for example, he talked about dumping. There's a record of the last midnight meeting of the State Council, China's cabinet, when they agree finally to sign up to WTO. And somebody raises concerns about an anti-dumping clause. And Zhu Rongji, who was a very caustic man, he's still alive, he's 95 or so now, he had a sharp tongue, and he said, well, our companies are dumping things on each other all the time. They're dumping stuff all over China from one province to another. It's causing chaos. It will serve our purpose if we make everybody agree to a rules-based system. So they saw the economic opportunity, they saw the theoretical justification, and they saw a rules-based framework which would serve them.
And despite their entry into the World Trade Organization, WTO, in 2001, there are current narratives that suggest that that was an easy process. But in fact, it wasn't, was it?
The Chinese accession to WTO was one of the longest and most arduous negotiations in the organization's existence. WTO came into existence in 1995. It replaced the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, as we've said. China had been negotiating for some years, and the original target was that China would join at the formation of WTO. In fact, it took 5 years longer, because suddenly, when you go to Geneva and you look at the WTO documents, which are voluminous and very accurate and unbiased, there's a report of a working party from the late 1990s, which I think met 21 times to review progress, and that illuminates the hard concerns of countries like Brazil, India, Japan, Kenya, other countries that saw their own interests economically potentially threatened by China and they wanted to constrain it. And then there were countries like the United States which wanted to create a better environment for their own businesses inside China. It was tough, and the Chinese didn't get away easily. So there is a narrative, as you've said, Paul, where people on the MAGA right in America like to talk about a seamless conspiracy by which people in Davos and Wall Street somehow ushered China in to the WTO so that all those peasants could lend money to America and destroy American industries. It didn't happen like that. It was, again, these are decisions that were taken above the heads of voters. How many news stories can you find from the 1990s which really traced the 5 years of negotiations, which changed all our lives. Very few, because it was boring and technical and behind closed doors, and weren't many journalists in Geneva who followed these kind of things. It was very specialised. And then it just emerged. What is true is that the Americans were absolutely critical. There were two processes in WTO accession. One, a negotiating stream bilaterally between China and the United States and between China and its other partners, and then one with the WTO as a whole. And the WTO then skillfully orchestrated the rival sets of negotiations and wove it together into an agreement at the end. I mean, a real diplomatic feat, technically speaking, and bureaucratically speaking. It came down in the end to the US versus China. And it was Bill Clinton who paused the process. There are several missteps. One of them, Zhu Rongji, goes to Washington expecting to sign a deal and doesn't get a deal and goes back to China with his tail between his legs. Shades of today. Eventually, Clinton appointed a very sharp trade lawyer called Charlene Barshefsky, and she oversaw the last rounds of negotiations. Very tough bargainer. She's spoken about it on the record. She's written extensively about her experience. Yeah, it was vicious negotiation down to the wire with walkouts and packing the bags in the hotel and, you know, ultimata, midnight appearances. It's very dramatic. She spoke about it at the time. They did get a deal. Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji signed off on it, and China was in. People didn't realise in the aftermath of that that was just the beginning of the story. It wasn't the end of the story.
And a decade after China is the world's largest exporter and the country also with the largest foreign exchange reserves, how did it get there?
There was a man called Long Yongtu, who was China's chief negotiator in Geneva, who was widely respected even by his opponents as a formidable intellect and a really skillful negotiator. He was negotiating with himself part of the time and with people in Beijing and with his counterparts in Geneva. He said a decade later that nobody envisaged at the time that within 10 years China would emerge in this extraordinary position. They thought that it would take longer, but there was an explosion of peace and prosperity and a lack of great power competition. You know, Russia was going through its own travails with its regional problems. United States was diverted by the war on terror, and China was content to do what Deng Xiaoping enjoined, which was to hide its strength and bide its time. So it did take them by surprise. They didn't react as quickly as they might have done. Jiang Zemin was quite old when he was in his second term as president. And he was succeeded by a duo, President Hu Jintao and his prime minister, Wen Jiabao, who, roughly speaking, more on the left. They weren't as keen on globalization and China reaching out and marketizing. There was a rollback of the state in the sense that the state restored its control over various sectors. They were more on the left. They also dealt with the global financial crisis of 2008. So let's not forget how important that is in Chinese psychology. I think Hank Paulson, who was the US Treasury Secretary, met one of his counterparts after the financial crisis, Wang Qishan, a very adept politician in China. And Paulson remembers being told, well, we were all looking to you for lessons, but what are we supposed to learn now? So there were changes that nobody predicted. And China's course just went on. You know, I often compare the Chinese economy to the American army in World War II. There's a trilogy of books about the American army in the North African campaign. And the first one describes the absolute chaos, poor generalship, bad logistics, which accompanied the first American landings in Africa in 1943. But it was so big, it had so many resources behind it, and it had such determined people at the top that in the end you could not stop it. And that's quite similar to how the Chinese economy rolls along.
On the US side, in the same period, do you think US presidents could have behaved differently to China if it wasn't a priority? How did that sort of come across US presidents' desks, and what were the debates they had about how to deal with China's rise?
President Trump likes to present himself as the change maker in China policy, but actually the change began under Barack Obama. There was a pivot to Asia, as Obama himself called it, when they began to realise that China was coming up very fast and it was not behaving by the rules that the Americans had expected. So Bill Clinton's negotiator, Charlene Barshefsky, the woman who sealed the deal, later gave a very critical assessment of what happened in Washington. She gave an interview in 2019, so during the Trump first term, and she described how there was no will under the George W. Bush or Obama administrations, or indeed the first Trump administration, to take China on. The WTO provided for arbitration and judgments by which one party could obtain satisfaction from another. And I think I'm right in saying that Barshefsky pointed to only one instance where the Americans had lodged a serious action. And she says, she calls it opportunity lost. You know, late Clinton, Bush, Obama, they didn't want to take China on because they didn't want confrontation.
And why is that? I mean, you've put your finger on something there, Michael, which is the contrasting natures of the two political systems there. Obviously, American politicians are, to a certain or lesser extent, behest to their electorate, as we've discovered. China's leaders are not. And so you have the nature of tyranny, dictatorship, which is what it is, let's call it what it is, but also this dubious relationship with the idea of treaties that underpin this. I mean, I wonder if we could explore that in some way, that contrast there, which is, you seem to be suggesting that that's crucial and central to this relationship.
Perhaps the most appropriate metaphor is the philosopher Isaiah Berlin's of the fox and the hedgehog. So the fox knows many things. You're the American president, you have to know many things. You're dealing with the Middle East, global war on terror, problems at home, Russia, strategic arms, lots of things coming across your desk every day. Even a person as intellectually accomplished as John Kennedy would have struggled in today's data-saturated environment. On the other hand, you have the hedgehog, and the hedgehog knows one thing, which is it has to survive. That is the governing principle of totalitarian systems. First of all, survival. Second of all, expansion. And thirdly, growth and strengthening their own global position. So American presidents were diverted by many other problems. Politically, the global war on terror put them in alignment with China on certain areas of Muslim extremism, for example. And the Chinese just concentrated on one thing, which was building up their own power and strength and their reserves and their economy until they were in a position to issue a global challenge, which is what they have now done.
That's the pressures of being number one, isn't it, in the US?
That's right. The Chinese say, they aver that they do not want to be number one because they don't want the responsibility that comes with it. In fact, they argue with some intellectual coherence that there should not be a number one. Xi Jinping talks about a multilateral world, a multipolar world in which there are different spheres of influence. The problem from our point of view is that he considers himself as one of those spheres of influence along with his friend Mr. Putin. So I don't think the rest of the world is ready to accept that division just right now.
I'm struck when you talked about the mentality of the nomenclatura, that class of technocrats, the long-term thinking but the sense of grasping opportunity, which Lenin would absolutely have recognised as a key political strength. Do you think that the authoritarian, tyrannical system that has come into being under Xi is also creating a class who have particular political strengths, or is it degrading the very things that allowed China to do those incredible things or to see those long-term opportunities?
Well, the internal politics of China are the, you know, proverbial riddle inside an enigma, but we know a number of things. One is that the technocrats have, broadly speaking, been eclipsed. Mm. They have taken a back seat. If you analyse the language used by Xi Jinping in his speeches and public pronouncements, which is all we have, he doesn't do off-the-cuff interviews or podcasts or things of that nature, the vocabulary is all about security. It's about stability. It's about foreign threats. It's about military matters. Security is the watchword. Previously, growth and development were the watchwords. So there's been a change in register, a vibe shift inside China. No question that national security is the number one priority. You can see it in the trade war. Look at what Xi Jinping has ordered right now. This is not just a numbers game. They have matched American tariffs, but they've also taken strategic moves, for example, by restricting the exports of at least half a dozen rare earths, which are minerals vital to all manner of new technology devices, including F-35 fighters. So they are thinking differently and more strategically. The concern, I think, among allies of the United States right now is that you can be careless. One thing that Obama wasn't, and the first, the George W. Bush administration wasn't, was careless. Perhaps they were too careful, but they did not do things that were reckless or badly thought out. Their sins were those of omission, I think, rather than commission. And the one challenge that President Trump has posed to the Chinese system is it's a slow system. It's not very reactive. It's governed by ritual and political process of its own kind. So they do not just pick up the phone and off the top of their heads give a new answer to question of a tariff number. I think that example shows from previous diplomatic negotiations with China. WTO process is certainly one of them. If you look at how it was brought to a conclusion between 1995 and 2001, it was done by slow, patient, serious, persistent diplomacy, in which the United States, the West, and the other industrial powers got what they wanted.
Yeah, in the terms of the time, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The WTO framework provided a realistic and positive way for China to expand peacefully and develop its economy, raising all boats at the same time. The problem was that it went off the rails.
How does Xi talk about WTO entry? Is he cynical about China's entry?
Xi Jinping doesn't talk directly about WTO entry, but he and his ministers, his prime minister, Li Qiang, have repeatedly talked it up. In the last 6 to 8 weeks, they have become apostles of free trade. And there's a remarkable phone call between Li Qiang, the prime minister, and Ursula von der Leyen of the European Union, in which Li Qiang invites the European Union to become China's partner in ensuring free and fair trade. So they have now talked, they've integrated the World Trade Organization into their political template, along with the United Nations, for what they see as a fair international order. So this may lead to an embrace of the WTO by China, but it knows pragmatically that that's an organization in big trouble. The Americans neutered it by refusing to nominate judges to its panel of adjudicators. So it can't actually arbitrate at the moment. It's been cut off at the knees. But I don't think there's any doubt historically that from 1949 to 1976, China turned inwards. From 1976 to 78, it began to experiment. And from 1978 to 2001, it was a wild period of excitement and exploration and innovation, which gave a whole generation of Chinese people new life. After 2001, we've seen crises, we've seen the wars in the Middle East, we've seen the world financial crisis, we've seen COVID-19, which we haven't talked about, and shocks to the Chinese system, all of which it has absorbed. So this is a very resilient system. They think they've got it right. They may not have got it right, but if you read Chinese media, social media, government statements, ministerial pronouncements at meetings, they feel confident that their system is a resilient one and they think they're going to come out on top in all this.
But historically speaking, do you bet on that system?
I'm an optimist about China, as I've said in another Engelsberg podcast. I was there in 1989 and saw the students and the uprising, the peaceful uprising in the streets of Shanghai. Incredibly impressive people. Any country would have been proud of those young people. And you see today in the Chinese system a great silence. Everybody applauds Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping thought on this, that and the other. Xi Jinping is mortal. He's 72 years old or so. One day he will be gone. There is no hereditary succession. It's not like North Korea. There's no family member or descendant of Xi Jinping in the picture. There's no evident successor. He's purged the only strong figures that were around, and that was a long time ago. So I would bet that when he goes, there would be a transition to a more collective authoritarian leadership. And the personality cult will drain away and be seen as the absurdity that it was. And that China, like other East Asian nations, can progress up the ladder of economic and political reform, which other dictatorships did. It's perfectly possible, and I think it could happen.
Well, Taiwan?
Taiwan is the living example of how Chinese people are perfectly capable of running a democratic free market economy without any cultural or psychological baggage supposedly accruing from their Confucian past. The Taiwanese military dictatorship gave way to democracy. It was done by an enlightened leader, the son of Chiang Kai-shek. But it gave an opportunity, as happened in other Asian countries, Indonesia, where I saw the revolution against Suharto, the Philippines, where
South Korea.
It's not simple or linear. It can be messy.
As we're seeing in South Korea. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, obviously, you don't want things to get messy in China. China is a nuclear power. Its arsenal is expanding. We know very little about its doctrine or command and control system. So trouble in China comes at great peril to other countries. And much as I instinctively sympathize with people like J.D. Vance and Matt Pottinger, the former National Security Advisor on China, who ultimately would like to see regime change, you have to be very careful what you wish for, but also when you wish for it.
What about in terms of technology? There's been a real fright that America has received with technological advances that China has been involved in. We're looking at the expansion of 6G, which you mentioned earlier in terms of advances there, the accumulation of data, which is very, very important to it, and also the way in which it has access to enormous amounts of energy, which we already see the new hydro dam that is being given the go-ahead in Tibet, for example. You know, it can call on energy as very few countries can, the United States being another one, of course. I mean, what are the implications for this for the future? You know, now we're in futurology.
Well, the Chinese do futurology. In fact, if you look at the rhetoric of the last few months, President Trump, Vice President Vance are talking about concepts like borders, sovereignty, control, enforcement, governing the space that you're in. These are 19th century power concepts. If you read what Xi Jinping and his underlings are talking about, they talk about the 21st century. They talk about 21st century technology and power and influence and a new economy that is going to be built on a digital foundation. They've already done that in China. They have used these years since COVID-19 to intensify their control, to use digital technology to liberate the consumer, but also to keep the government informed. And, of course, they've done the infrastructure. So I've read some recent accounts by Americans who've gone back to China after the COVID exclusions and been stunned at the extent to which China has become a seamless digital society. If you are an urban dweller, on your phone is everything you need for your daily life, finances, transport, entertainment, love, social exchanges. The Ministry of State Security is across every single byte of data. It works for them. Add to that the high-speed rail network, the highway network, the airport network. They have done infrastructure in a way that the United States cannot match, simply hasn't done it. And so I think if you look at what's happening inside China, that accounts for this feeling of confidence. What are they investing in? They're investing in artificial intelligence. They're throwing money at state-approved conglomerates like Huawei, which recently gave American journalists a tour of this incredible Silicon Valley-like campus in eastern China. They are placing their bets on this, and I think they take the view that the Trump-Vance administration will be gone in 3 years plus, and they'll still be there. They're talking about the 21st century, and the worry is that American politicians are haggling over the 19th.
Mm. And that's an interesting point of this great power prism that both American and European politicians and historians think through, going back to Paul Kennedy in the 1980s, of course, when he was writing about, you know, when Japan was this great potential enemy. And, of course, at the time of when Donald Trump first became a public figure, of course. But Kennedy himself has talked about a new tripolar world of the future where Europe becomes very much a second, even third-rate power, and we see the ascendancy, as we've seen, of the United States and China, but also India. And I wondered if you got any sense of, we know what China thinks about the United States aggression, you know, that is much discussed, that rivalry. But I wonder about India.
There's a huge amount of brain power in Delhi being trained on China, and a huge amount of brain power in China being trained on India and its sphere of influence. Remember, China's behaved with shocking lack of scruple in the past. It essentially gave nuclear warheads to Pakistan as a blunt, stark strategic choice. They've moved on from that. One thing to remember is that the neuralgic point of Chinese politics is foreign interference, foreign involvement. Broadly speaking, there's little territorial dispute between India and China. They are rivals in the Himalayas, but these are not significant strategic areas of land. It doesn't match the sensitivity they feel to American and Western naval and air patrols up and down their coastline between Japan and Singapore, essentially. Now, we would say that these are strategic arrangements that protect the sea lanes and guarantee world commerce, and under the United States Navy and Air Force and its allies, the Pacific has enjoyed peace since 1945. The Chinese make no bones of their wish to overturn that order, to throw the Americans out of what they call the first island chain around China, and to expel the United States and its influence to the other side of the Pacific. They couldn't harbour any such aspirations towards India because essentially their borders are static. In terms of trade, I read the Indian argument. Prime Minister Modi puts it eloquently. But the reality is that India in its present state is not a match for China in the global supply chain or a manufacturing alternative. It's a different pole, as it were. The Chinese take India seriously. The bilateral relationship is managed at high level. As I've said, there's a lot of brain power on both sides goes into it. I think the strategic objective for China right now is very, very focused on the contest with America. It wants to offset Europe if it can. It has this arrangement, peculiar arrangement with Russia, in which, you know, to some extent, Russia is China's gas station. And India is not a significant strategic power in Chinese considerations. I mean, nobody in China thinks that India is going to come and invade it. So the outlook from Beijing is one, I think, of satisfaction. They see the world going in Xi Jinping's direction. Now, there's a lot of shocks that can happen along the way, but right now you only have to read the writings and speeches of Chinese people like the new envoy to Europe, who frankly revel in the dissension, disarray and confusion in the democracies. They see the Western enemy, the democratic enemy, as slowly cutting its own throat. They are content to sow division within democratic societies and between democracies. So in that sense, the trade war and competition between the US and its allies and the loss of faith by allies in the United States guarantee is a strategic windfall. That also explains why they have not been deviated from their alliance with Mr. Putin. They see the autocratic model as superior, effective, capable of generating what they call true democracy, whole process democracy, and prosperity for more people, as a better model to be exported to other countries in what they call the global south. Mm. So they feel that time is on their side.
And that's a term they've weaponized as well, isn't it, global south?
At the risk of being heretical, China is not itself in the global south. It's in the global north geographically. Mm. And one wonders whether countries like Chile or Australia and New Zealand supposed to be in the global south. So it's a bit of a misnomer. The now banned phrase, the third world, was actually evoked by Chairman Mao. So they pick up these phrases politically as and when suits them. But to be serious for a second, the Chinese offer used to be restricted to China. When Mao died, China explicitly renounced the export revolution. In fact, Xi Jinping, on one of his rare foreign trips as vice president, said in Latin America in a well-quoted speech that China does not export revolution and does not seek to impose its system on others. But what we now see is that China is very keen at exporting its governance model to countries in Africa, for example, and in Latin America, where it talks about things like development rights. That means the rights of countries to get rich and prosper without Western constraints and influence. They talk about order and security and governance. I heard a remarkable report on the BBC only this week that they have sold 30,000 surveillance cameras to the Taliban in Afghanistan, which now enforce law and order and discipline on the streets of Kabul. So they are incrementally moving to expand their influence, not merely through dollars and yuan and bridge building and railway building, but also through ideas. There are more and more meetings and exchanges in China for people from Africa, for example. And it's not just about technology, it's about governance systems. Mm-hmm. Add that to the digital revolution that is occurring in China, exploited by COVID-19. They used COVID-19 as a methodology to perfect population control and movements through apps on phones, which then linked to everything else. They have also got, as you pointed out, Paul, huge data sets. They are applying artificial intelligence to enormous data sets, which they have accumulated without being able to exploit. So if you talk to Western intelligence officers in the past, they always said, well, we know the Chinese are very good at collecting information, but we don't think they can do anything with it because they just can't sort it and sift it and analyze it. Well, AI gives them the opportunity even to go back through historic data sets and look at people's movements, communications, data searches, messages, electronic communications. Number one, it's a bonanza. Number two, unlike Western intelligence services, which need to make choices and priorities, they have practically limitless human resources. So although Xi Jinping is in his 70s, and although he thinks in a very old way, he is leading a country that is far more modern than many of its rivals like to think.
Mm. There's a powerful half-truth there, though, in the technology point, that I imagine apostles for that ordered technological society will look at examples like California and say, look, America, you invented all this high technology. It's wonderful technology. We've reverse-engineered aspects of it and applied it. What have you created? You've created anarchy. You've created a society which has no order, which, you know, and there's a half-truth there, you know. So I wonder whether that's part of the pitch. You know, we are using technology to produce an ordered society.
Well, this comes back to their idea of democracy, doesn't it, in a different sense, where that fulfilment of everyone rather than the enrichment of a few, at least ideologically.
They talk about technology and order. At the beginning of the digital age, when the internet came to China and social media came to China and phones came to China, superseding fax machines, people, including Bill Clinton, talked eloquently about how you can't turn back the tide of freedom and digital empowerment would liberate people and a middle class would rise up and inform itself and become politically aware. It didn't happen. The Chinese state proved equal to the challenge of technology. They simply took it on. They installed the great firewall to block content they didn't like, and they hired tens of thousands of censors and social media monitors to check on what people were saying. Any Chinese dissident or a person protesting about a real estate development will find out quickly that the police have found their smartphone, their address, their ID card, and come to arrest them. That's how it works. So the promise of the internet turned out to be a betrayal. And the internet did not empower the Chinese people politically. It's empowered them as consumers, but it's also empowered the state. So it's a completely altered vision to the Californian vision. And we're only at the frontiers, really, of the debate about where that technology and use of data takes people in Western democratic societies. Xi Jinping has his vision, which he has said explicitly, is one of digital order.
Is there some sadness, do you think, in China? That, you know, that vision to me sounds very cold. It's very materialistic. And when I look at other societies where materialism reigns, I think of it as a failure. You know, I think of it as a kind of cultural sickness, actually, or an answer to problems that you can't solve or have not been able to solve. In China, is there a sense that, you know, they wish that they'd be able to build something with less of a cold feel?
Younger people in China report a feeling of emptiness, particularly since COVID-19, which was a period when restrictions and harsh rules were enforced on large numbers of the population in ways that exceeded anything done in the West. And it left people with a feeling of anomie. It led to a movement called lying flat, which is a Chinese expression that simply implies a young person who would rather lie flat than go out to work and strive and achieve. There's been a revolt against the tech bosses in China who believe that people should work from 9 to 9, 6 days a week. Mm. A lot of people are opting out of that. As in other societies, real estate prices went out of reach of many young people. There's been a sense of dislocation and a feeling of emptiness, which the party is doing its best to fill. Prosperity alone is not enough. There's limited evidence of a growth in interest in religions. Christianity continues to thrive. Xi Jinping himself, in researching the biography, I found a limited amount of his interest in religion as a young man, as a student, where he was curious about Buddhist theology and its integration with Chinese Confucian traditions and Taoism. He sees that as a cultural artifact. He doesn't see it as a philosophy or a way of life. There is an emptiness. They said in the 1990s and the early 2000s that China had abandoned Maoism, which was a kind of cult, and had not found anything else. And they found that consumerism replaced that to some extent, but that also became empty. So there is a hunger and a search. There's also, remember, in China, a search for survival. People need jobs. You have disintegrated family networks because you had a whole generation, several generations, of children from one-child families. Those restrictions were only removed a few years ago. Now the government is finding that people actually don't want to have more children because they're frightened of the responsibility and the costs of looking after them. Mm. They have an ageing crisis. Parents, elderly parents, separated from their children because the children have migrated to work in the coastal areas, for example.
Though I'm sure these have a particular Chinese identity to them, these don't sound like phenomenon problems that are absent in the West either. When you talk about loneliness, when you talk that search for meaning, you talk about that stuff about Christianity, that search for that, this, I'm sure that there are particular Chinese characteristics and experiences and factors behind this. But this seems like a general malaise with consumerism anyway.
Well, they call it lying flat. Mm, we call it bedrock.
Yeah.
So But, I mean, young people who spend a lot of time on their phones, I don't see as particularly happy. So in China, you talk about everything being accessible through your phone. Again, does that actually create happy and productive people who can then go out and strive and be active participants in the economy and all that? I just find it bemusing.
Well, remember, TikTok is a Chinese entity. It's not called TikTok in China, but it's the same algorithm and the same idea. Well, the best way that was put to me was by a former American security official who said, well, TikTok is digital fentanyl. It's there to numb you. You're never going to discover startling, innovative, challenging things because you're always going to be fed the same material. We haven't even begun to get across this. And there's an argument that maybe governments and free societies have no business in intervening as to what people watch on their phones or control the input. No question that Xi Jinping and his government sense correctly that they are navigating very uncharted waters, but they have the big picture, like I talked about the fox and the hedgehog earlier. You know, they know one thing, which is they need to keep going forward. And they don't really care about collateral impact. So, for example, Chinese goods exported to the United States amount to less than 15% of overall Chinese exports. So if those exports are penalized and people pay a price in China in lost jobs and closed factories and bankruptcies, they will weather that. They're not going to give in. They don't do that. So this is a regime, as it showed in COVID-19, that is ready and willing to take draconian and apparently self-harming measures if it thinks that its survival is at stake. And that is a far more disciplined approach than you have in turbulent Western democracies. It's just part of the factor.
Is it not a small step to go from limitless manpower to the idea of limitless human material?
The Chinese talk about a talents program. They originally formulated the idea for attracting 1,000 talents back to China from scientists and researchers in higher education in the United States and the West. They have a huge talent reserve. They are able to employ legions of graduates in government service to do things like internet surveillance. They talk about entrepreneurialism. Xi Jinping recently met the top 50 entrepreneurs and talked up the private sector and encouraged them to foster innovation and bring young people in and so on. But it's all within a framework of control.
Yeah. And surely there's the people who don't fit into that framework are expendable.
They are expendable and they are powerless. I'm skeptical about projections of the fall of the Chinese system or radical change to the Chinese system. I've been listening since 1989 to journalists sitting around in bars predicting that the system is going to collapse and it couldn't possibly continue. Well, it did continue and we were wrong and they were right. They devote a huge amount of brain power and management assets to predicting and preventing challenges and change. On one level, they're not wrong that the Chinese Communist Party is a very responsive organism. It reaches down into the population and it hears people's complaints. And it very often addresses those complaints with Xi Jinping's relentless and endless campaigns against corrupt officials and local governments that steal assets and steal land and don't pay people. All that is true. But it's managed in a way that doesn't challenge the system as a whole. I mean, just like Stalin, instances of waste, stupidity, corruption, treachery and so on are all treated as isolated aberrations from a perfect norm. The perfect norm is Xi Jinping thought and the rule of the party, and it is a leviathan. Its power has increased since COVID-19. Attacks from the outside are a sense that China is being ganged up on, or that the Americans are trying to stop China rising, feed this kind of popular narrative. Now, I know from having gone around China for 20 years and talked to people high and low, without surveillance many of times, Chinese people are just as robust and cynical and humorous and full of character as anyone else. They're not natural conformists. They are just like other people. That you have as many personalities in China as anywhere else, and they have 100 schools of thought. It's just that right now, under this regime, all that is suppressed.
Michael, if you could indulge us with a bit of futurology, could you bring us back to that optimistic picture of China's future that you explored earlier? Is there a branching history where those 100 schools of thoughts you talk about, at least some of them get expressed, and we can then talk about them on future podcasts? You know?
Long term, I'm optimistic that China will progress towards true economic and political reform. Xi Jinping himself says that this is a 5,000-year-old civilization with a rich tradition of education and culture and political thought. It's given many lessons to the rest of the world. And I always remember the students I met in Shanghai in 1989 who were quoting Byron and Shelley in their speeches from the barricades. They had the same vision that many other young people around the world had in 1989, may indeed have today. Also, just the political dynamics will change. Xi Jinping is in his early 70s. We know very little about his state of health, but he won't be there forever. There is no hereditary succession. No member of his family stands to inherit his power. There's no evident successor. The big rivals were all neutered many years ago. So I think that when he goes, the party will regress to a form of collective leadership that will hopefully abandon the absurdities of a personality cult, be less nationalistic, and take China on that long, slow direction towards reform that other East Asian countries have successfully followed in the past.
Well, thanks, Michael. That was absolutely fascinating, and thanks for coming on. And please do read Michael's fantastic writing on the site. It's under his author page. Anyway, thanks for coming on, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones, and EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. Till next time, thanks for listening.